We do want him after all. Because I'm just saying, we could all leave now and go to the beach. Skinny dip or something. She stands back upright and laughs again. You're welcome, she says, for that image I just put in your heads of me skinny dipping. Then she reaches into her massive bra and whips out some bottle of essential oil that she says I need to inhale because it will calm me down, bring on the positive vibes, center my aura. She puts it under my nose. It smells like roses and lavender. She's chanting something I can't quite hear, closing her eyes, and she presses her forehead up against mine in a mind meld and says, "For the good of all and the free will of all, so mote it be." And then she opens her eyes and looks around at us. "Look, sweetie, I've got to get back to the family. The natives are getting restless out there, trying to figure out what's come over the prodigal son. Figure out if this is all their fault. Raising him so entitled and all." She wrinkles her nose. "I'm sorry he's putting you through this. I really do think there might be something wrong with that boy.
Maybe he just overslept," I say. "Or maybe the bridge is stuck in the up position and he can't get across. Or maybe he misplaced part of his tux, and he didn't realize which tux shop my dad was using, so he's lost. And his phone isn't charged."
Blix laughs. "Yeah, and maybe Mercury is in retrograde, too. Or he's got jet lag.
Or there are sunspots.
Who knows?
But you are going to be fine. Big life. Remember that.
I told you that.
A big, big life for you."
She blows kisses to all of us and sashays out. And that's when I hear it. The roar of Whipple's BMW out in the parking lot.
They're here.
58 minutes late, but they're here. And oxygen flows back into the room like somebody turned on the valve once again. I stand up, still shaking. We hear pounding footsteps, and then the door bursts open, and there is Noah, standing there looking more like he's arriving to film a battle scene than to get married. His hair is sticking up all over the place, and he didn't shave, and his eyes are like little black dots in a sea of bloodshot white space. And oh my God, he is wearing his tuxedo shirt with his pair of blue jeans. I put my hand over my mouth. I may be making a little sound, something a pigeon would say.
"Marnie," he says. "Marnie, I have to talk to you."
He leads me outside. Outside, outside. Not to the parking lot or the little sidewalk area in front where all the nice people gather after church to talk. No, he takes me by the hand to the meadow off to the side of the church where the church school holds picnics. Where I got my first kiss when I was in seventh grade. Steve Peacock. His parents are right now in that church waiting to watch me get married.
"Marnie,"
he says, and his mouth is so dry it makes a clacking sound when he talks. I want him to stop saying my name. I want him to look normal and happy and groom-like, but none of that is going to happen.
"Marnie," he says. "Baby, I am so, so sorry. But I'm afraid there is no way I can do this."
And the world, the big, vast, beautiful world, vanishes, shrinking down to a little point right in front of me. The only thing left is the blood roaring through my ears and some deep feeling that nothing, nothing is ever going to make sense again. 4. Marnie. This kind of thing has actually happened to me before. In third grade, I was chosen to be Mary in the Christmas Eve pageant. I was to wear my mother's blue filmy bathrobe, and I made a foil halo that tied to my plastic headband. Being Mary was the high point of my life up to that time, a life in which I was already realizing that my older sister Natalie was going to walk away with all the best prizes, things she didn't even seem to strive for. Good grades, teacher's admiration, boyfriends, the plastic diamond ring in the Cracker Jack box.
But Natalie couldn't be Mary because she had already been Mary 2 years ago, and so she had to be a shepherd. It was all me, and I would be propped up there by the manger, holding the Smith's 8-week-old baby, who was playing the part of baby Jesus. Mrs. Smith had taught me how to support the baby's head and everything. But when we went to the church for the pageant, it turned out there was a terrible mix-up. According to the rules, Janie Hopkins, a fourth grader, was really the next in line to be Mary. There was a list, you see. And even though Janie hadn't been to Sunday school in months, now she was here. And besides, she was going to move away in the spring and was sad about it. So the Sunday school director knelt down to my level, and looking at me with her eyes all full of feeling, she told me she hoped I'd understand, but we really did have to be Christian about it and let Janie be Mary. My throat closed up, but I managed to say, "Of course, fine." I took off the halo and the bathrobe, and I sat in the audience because by then there wasn't even a shepherd costume for me. And then in 9th grade, Todd Yellen called the house, and when I answered the phone, he asked me to go to the movies with him, and I said yes. And the next day at school, when I went over to him at lunchtime, it turned out that he had thought he was talking to Natalie instead of me, and that's who he wanted to take. Natalie. She wasn't even in his grade. I was. And then in 12th grade, the worst thing of all happened. My boyfriend, Brad Whitaker, the coolest guy in the whole senior class, somehow forgot we were boyfriend and girlfriend and asked someone else to the prom. And here I am, the same old Marnie, only now it's so much worse because it's my wedding day, damn it. The day I get to have it be about me and the man who said he loved me. Only the light is too bright, the bees too loud, and Noah's hands are shoved in his jeans pockets, and he is walking in circles, looking down at the ground. And it's also unfair because he loved me first, damn it. He was the one who thought it was time we moved in together. A guy who is so adventurous and amazing that he proposed to me on an ultralight plane he'd rented just for that purpose, not realizing it would be so loud up there that he'd have to shout, and that the gusting wind was going to send the engagement ring sailing into the sky, and that he'd have to buy a new one. Also, he wrote an actual song to sing at the wedding, a song about our love. And he tells me he loves me all the time. He brings me a bag of chocolate almonds every Friday afternoon. He polishes my toenails. And he lights candles around the bathtub for me. And whenever I start feeling low about missing my family, he declares we're having a play hooky day, and we stay in the house in our pajamas eating ice cream out of the carton and drinking beer. And now he has gone out of his mind. It's a panic attack. That's all this is. I take a deep breath and reach out and take his hand. "Noah," I hear myself say. "It's okay, honey. Take a deep breath. Here, sit down. Let's take deep breaths together," I say. "Marnie, listen, I love you too much to do this to you. It's not going to work. We're not going to make it. I see that now. I'm so, so sorry, baby, but I can't." "Of course we're going to make it," I hear myself say. "We love each other, and that's..." "No! No, it's not. It's not enough to love each other. You think I want to do this to you? Marnie, I'm fucked up. I'm not ready to do the husband thing. I thought I could, but I have stuff I still need to do. I can't, baby." My mouth goes dry.
"Is there someone else? Do you have another woman?"
"No," he says. His eyes dart away. "God, no! No one, it's not that." "Then what is it?" "I can't put it into words. I just can't say those vows. I can't settle down yet. Be some man with a lawnmower."
"A lawnmower? What the hell does a lawnmower have to do with it?"
He's quiet. "Is it the permanence? That's what the lawnmower means? Just what the hell is it about the lawnmower, Noah?
He puts his hands over his face and sits down in the tall grass. I start laughing.
Oh, I know what this is. You and Whipple stayed up all night, didn't you? And now you're hungover and sleep-deprived, and you're probably dehydrated. You need to eat every few hours, and you need at least 6 hours of sleep, or you go crazy.
He doesn't answer me, just keeps his head in his hands.
Damn it, Noah Spinnaker. People are waiting for us, and all you need is a nap, some ibuprofen, and about a gallon of ice water, maybe a Bloody Mary, and maybe a cheeseburger with onion rings, and you'll be fine.
It's suddenly crystal clear, even in its craziness. I plop myself down on the ground next to him. I am the only one who can save him, and the only way to save him is to marry him. And yes, there will be grass stains and possibly mud on my dress, but I don't care. I rub his back, his fine, muscled back that I have rubbed 1,000 times and want to spend at least the next 50 years rubbing.
Noah, darling, it's all right.
Listen, I love you more than life itself, and I know that we are meant to be together, and that we are going to have a happy marriage.
No,
he says into his arm.
It won't work.
It will work, trust me. And if it doesn't, so what?
We'll get divorced. People do it all the time.
There's a silence, and then he says, divorce is terrible. I explain then how much more terrible it would be if one of us has to walk into that church and break the hearts of my parents and all the people sitting there by announcing there will not be a wedding because of lawnmowers. After a moment, he says, what if we're making a huge mistake?
It's not a mistake,
I say, and I realize I believe that with all my heart.
Anyway, let's make a mistake if we have to.
So what?
That's what living is, Noah. Failing and making mistakes and figuring it out as you go along for next time. At least we're alive and trying things.
Listen, let's just do this. If we have to get a divorce tomorrow, we will. But today, we'll go in there and say those words out loud, and everybody will clap for us, and then we'll dance a waltz and eat some wedding cake, and we'll go on the honeymoon because windsurfing in Costa Rica sounds pretty good, doesn't it? And then we'll come back, and if we want to, we'll get a divorce.
Oh my God, you're insane, he says. You're actually fucking crazy.
It would be hard at this moment to say for sure who is more insane, I say in a low voice.
Come on,
let's go drink to a big mistake. I have him. I see with some surprise that I am stronger than he is and that I always have been. Let me put this another way, I say amicably. My hands are on my hips. I am marrying you today. I just am. So get up. Suck it up and come with me. And he does. He actually does it. I am not even surprised when he gets up. I knew he would. We don't touch each other on the way into the church. We walk in quickly, with our heads down, and we stride down the aisle together, him in his jeans and me in my grass-stained wedding dress, and people actually stand up and clap for us.
They do.
They clap so hard it's as though we're Prince and Michael Jackson and possibly even Elvis and the Three Stooges, all returned from the dead. I keep smiling. I don't know what he's doing because I can't bring myself to look at him, but when we get to the altar and the ceremony starts, we say the words we're supposed to say, like all this never happened. I'm just there, getting married, like so many women before me. And maybe when I stop to unpack all my emotions, I'll figure out how I really feel. But for now, I just keep moving forward, and so does he. And finally, we hear the words,
I now pronounce you husband and wife, and Noah kisses me, and together we run down the aisle, and everything is just like I thought it would be, except for the feeling in the pit of my stomach, like I've just come down a mile-high hill on a roller coaster and realized the track ahead of me is broken. The reception, held at my parents' country club, is lovely, even if I spend a lot of it knocking back more cocktails than is medically advisable, and dancing with anyone who will dance with me, getting more and more raucous as the night wears on. For some reason, Noah goes ahead and sings the song he wrote to me, which has all the right sentiments since he wrote it back when he still wanted to marry me. And when he sings it, people go, "Aww." Then he sings another and another, like he can't stop himself. He just needs the attention. Some people ask me what the holdup was all about, and I tell them, "Oh, it was just some mix-up with the time and the tuxedo shop." I wave my arms as though it's all nothing to us now. The wedding went forward, and we're married. And, ha-ha, every wedding needs some little drama to make it memorable, right? A bridegroom in jeans, arriving late with his nostrils flaring like a wild stallion who's been spooked? What of it? My new in-laws stay at their table, looking dismayed and judgmental. My parents' country club perhaps does not live up to the standards they like to see in polite society, so they keep to themselves. Or perhaps, given what's happened already today, they're thinking this marriage will only be temporary, so why should they make the effort? But Blix? I see Blix off to the side dancing with everyone, even the groomsmen, even Whipple at one point. When she comes over and pulls me out onto the floor with her, we close our eyes and smile and fling ourselves around with abandon, like maybe we're communicating something in our own perfect, unseen world. It's my wedding day, and I am married and doomed and half-drunk, flying on the outskirts of crazy, with the world tilting under my feet and the whole night opening up in the middle of my head. Later, after I have danced myself into a whirling frenzy, I go outside alone to get some air. I'm hanging over the railing of the deck, looking out at the moon shining on the swamp, and I'm soaking up the Florida humidity and wondering if I'd feel better if I let myself go ahead and throw up, when I hear a voice behind me. It's Blix. "Well, you've certainly got yourself an interesting wedding story to tell, don't you, my love?" She lowers her voice. "Are you doing okay?" I stand up straighter, put on my public happy bride face. "Hi! Yeah, I'm fine. Just dance too much is all." She gets busy taking off her shoes and loosening her blouse, flapping her skirt up and down, humming something. I look over at her. "I'm trying to cool off my legs," she says. "Do your legs get hot when you dance?" "I don't know. I guess so." I'm suddenly so very tired. I don't want her to see me this way, on the verge of tears. A gecko runs across the top of the deck and stops to look at me, then hurries off on a mission to catch mosquitoes. I give him my blessing and try to pull myself together.
"Whew! God, what a time this has been,"
Blix is saying.
"I think I've danced with everything on two legs tonight. And if there'd been some cats and dogs around, I probably would have danced with them as well."
She comes over and stands next to me, yawning and stretching her arms up in the air.
"Ah, fuck it," she says. "Can't we just be honest, you and me?"
"You don't have to answer that, because I'm going to tell you anyway. My grandnephew is a major dick."
"There. We probably should have done him in right when he arrived and found out he was still breathing."
"Maybe so." I scrape the railing with my manicured fingernail. The insects are screeching from the swamp below.
"He's got some work to do on himself. Some work on his auras, that's for sure."
I don't want to look at her. It already feels like her eyes are boring right through me. But when I do finally turn toward her, the kindness in her face almost levels me.
"I think what happened is that he just had a really bad panic attack today,"
I tell her. And that was probably because he didn't drink enough water. Anyway, he said he's sorry, so I think we're going to be okay.
Do you now?
She says. Her eyes are twinkling.
Well, let's go with that as the official version, then.
We've talked it out in the meadow, and we're going on the honeymoon, which will be nice. We're really good when we're traveling together. And then, when we come back, it'll just be our same life, living together like we've been doing already. And we'll settle down. I stop, remembering how she hates the settling down concept. She puts her hand on my arm.
Well, it is going to be all right, darling. But maybe not for the reasons you think. I hope you'll listen to me because I don't have a lot of time. You need to forget what society has told you about life and expectations, and don't let anybody make you pretend. You are enough, just the way you are. Do you hear me? You have many gifts. Many, many gifts.
To my horror, I burst into tears.
Oh, yeah. I'm just fantastic. You have to be a special kind of fantastic for a guy to decide on the wedding day that he's not going to go through with it.
She smiles and pats my cheek.
Now, now. Don't turn on yourself because of him acting like a jerk. Your life is going to be so big, Marnie. Such a big, inclusive, loving heart song of a life you've got in store. You're not going to give a shit about this guy. Trust me.
I don't think I want a big life.
I blubber at her, and she says,
oh, my, my, my.
And folds me into her massive, soft bosom, and we sway back and forth, kind of to the music that's playing inside, but kind of not.
I just want to be ordinary,
I say into her scarves and beads.
Can't I be ordinary?
Oh, my sweet girl. Oh, my goodness.
No, you can't be ordinary. Oh, heavens, no. I feel like I'm standing in front of a magnificent giraffe,
and she's saying to me, why do I have to be a giraffe? I don't think I'm going to go around giraffing anymore.
But that's just the way it is.
You're a wonderful, incredible giraffe, and you've got a life to lead that's going to take you to amazing places.
She squeezes me and then lets me go.
You know, sometimes I wish I wasn't at the end of life because I just want to stick around and watch your creations. All of them.
Wait, what do you mean the end of life? Are you dying?
I dab at my eyes with a handkerchief she produces. She gets a funny look on her face, and I'm sorry I asked the question. Of course. Noah told me she's 85. Any way you look at it, that's got to be pretty near the end of life.
Hey, so, listen, Ms. Giraffe. I came out here to tell you goodbye, because I've got to go back to the hotel now, she says. My plane leaves early in the morning, and Houndy called me to say that he's invited about 20 people over for lobsters tomorrow night. He can't help himself.
Then she smiles at me. The wind blows some sparkles around.
And you, she says. You've got some miracles to perform, honey child. Please try to remember that for me, okay? The world needs your miracles.
I don't know how to perform miracles, I tell her.
Well, then you better start practicing. Words are a good first step. They have a lot of power. You can summon things by believing in them. First, you visualize them being true, and then they come true. You'll see.
She kisses me on both cheeks, and then she heads through the door. But when she gets there, she turns around and says,
oh, I meant to tell you. You need a mantra to help you. You can borrow mine if you want. Whatever happens, love that.
When I get back inside, Noah comes over to me and holds out his arms, and we finally dance. I put my head on his shoulder, and I say, Are you feeling a little better? Did you get something to eat? This is probably a very wifely thing to say, and I realize he's probably resenting the hell out of it.
Yes, he says in a weary voice. Yes, I'm better. I ate some protein.
I feel so careful around him. Good. And you were singing a lot, you and Whipple. That must have been okay, right?
Then, who knows what, makes me brave enough to say this.
Maybe it's all the alcohol I've had, or Blix's words, or the fact that I'm feeling disconnected from reality. But I say the scary thing. What's next, do you think?
I don't know. The honeymoon?
Okay,
I say.
What about tonight?
What do you mean? Tonight we're going to the hotel, and we're going to have great sex and sleep late, like newlyweds.
There are some other things I want to know. Like, is he going to be my husband? And am I really his wife? Are those words we can use? He puts his arms around me, and we slow dance to another song, and then they turn the lights on, and I see that Noah's eyes have no light in them. The air around him is a muddy beige I've never noticed before. So, I guess my first miracle will have to be to try to light him back up.
5. Blix. It's a week after the wedding, and I'm back home now. My tumor wakes me up before sunrise. It is thrumming right below the surface of my skin, like something alive, running under its own power. "Hi, love," it says. "What shall we do today?" "Sweetheart," I say to it. "I was hoping for just a little more sleep this morning. Would you very much mind if we did that? And then later we can talk and do whatever you want." The tumor hardly ever goes for this kind of reasoning. And why should it? It knows I'm at its mercy. I've made friends with it because I don't believe in that whole battle metaphor for disease. You always read about that in obituaries, you know. So-and-so battled cancer for 5 years, or worse, he lost his battle with cancer. I do not believe cancer appreciates that kind of thinking. And anyway, I've made nice with trouble my whole life, and I've noticed that what happens is that problems just curl right up like declawed kittens and nestle at your feet and fall asleep. Later, you look down, and they've wandered off somewhere. You bid them a fond farewell and get back to what you wanted to do in the first place. In the interest of friendliness, I have given my tumor a name. Cassandra. She was the prophet nobody believed. I turn over in the bed and listen to Houndy softly snoring beside me, his grizzled, beautiful face tipped toward mine. I lie there in the grayness of dawn and watch him breathe in and out and feel the magic of the city waking up. After a long time, the sun comes up for real, and a long time after that, the 643 bus comes wheeling around the corner and hits the pothole at its usual breakneck speed, causing the metal chassis to complain and screech as it always does. The window panes shudder. Somewhere, if I listen, there's a siren starting up. An early summer morning in Brooklyn. The heat is already pressing against the window. I close my eyes and stretch. Cassandra, satisfied that I'm awake, goes back to whatever she was doing before she felt the call to wake me up. Sometimes she is as silent and worn out as time, and sometimes she's a rascally kindergartner wanting only to thump against something living. I place my hand against her and sing her a little song in my head. Call me crazy, but the day I named her Cassandra, I also started giving her nice things to wear. Some days, when she is fierce and hot, I picture her in a hard hat. And other days, like maybe today, I think of her in a lacy dress and invite her for tea. I tell her to imagine she has been given the most delicate and beautiful of my china cups, the one I hang on the hook over the stove. I will not forsake you, I say to Cassandra. I know you came for a reason, even though I'll be goddamned if I can figure out what that is. Last week, when I got back from the wedding, on a day when I was nearly doubled over in pain, I gave myself a huge reward for making it through and to celebrate meeting Marnie. I told Houndy and Lola that I'd found the person I'd been waiting for all my life, the someone I probably knew from many other lifetimes and who was my spiritual daughter. And then I painted the refrigerator bright turquoise. I was so proud of myself for not letting anyone in my family know that I am dying that I had to paint the refrigerator as my own little reward. Houndy, sweet old family-oriented Houndy, thinks I should just tell my family about the mass. Why not, he says. Don't they deserve to know? Maybe they'd want to be nicer to you. Ha! My family wouldn't want to be nicer to me. They'd want me locked up in some hospital, treating Cassandra with needles and knives and making me talk to doctors, people who would speak to me in that condescending medical way, people with clipboards and appointment books and computers, office assistants who would speak too loudly in my presence, as if Cassandra had somehow interfered with my ability to hear. No, thank you. I went to the doctor and got my diagnosis, which I will not dignify by using its medical terminology, because to say the words makes it feel fatal and incurable, and I refuse to go with that. Except I will say this. I got up from the examination table and put my clothes back on, thank you very much, and I tore up the pieces of paper they gave me, the treatment plan, and I walked out. And I will not go back. If Cassandra leaves my body, and she may, it could still happen, it will be of her own volition, and this will be the reason. Our work together is done. I don't want to die, but neither am I afraid. I won't use chemotherapy or put poison into my body. I won't suffer. Instead, I have taken energy drinks and done chants. I have consulted a shaman in an African village online. I have buried talismans and sowed seeds and performed yoga poses at midnight under a full moon. I have danced and primal screamed and practiced laughing out loud and had massages and acupuncture and Reiki. And by the look of things, Cassandra is thriving. So you know what that means? It means it's the way things are supposed to be. So I am going to die. Most natural thing in the world to have happen. Life ends. And I'm okay with that. It's just a change of address, really. It doesn't have to be awful. I sigh, kick off the sheets because I'm suddenly hot, and then I close my eyes and tune in to the conversation the pigeons are having on the windowsill. They always sound like they're on the verge of figuring everything out. Later, I get up and go to what Houndy calls my crazy-ass kitchen to make tea. Funny, these old Brooklyn brownstones. This one has a parquet floor that once was probably grand, but which now slopes down to the outside wall. It's a floor with personality, all pocked and scarred from a century of footsteps and boot heels and water leaks and even worse grievances than those, and a high tin ceiling with a glaring fluorescent ring of light in its yellowed center, a light I never turn on because it's harsh. It promotes ugliness, that light. Instead, I've put lamps all around, warm, yellowish light to give softness. Houndy says we could get the floor made level and maybe have the stairs replaced in the front of the house, get the roof fixed. He's a do-something kind of guy, not one to sit around and watch the metal rust. Finally, I had to say to him that I am all about slowing down all that striving. I just want to enjoy the sun coming through the cracks near the windows. I am tired of making so much effort. He doesn't take much convincing to see the point of things I say. And that's why I let him come and live here and sleep in my bed next to me. We never got married because I finally learned that if you have to bring the law into your personal relationships, then you're doing it wrong. And both Houndy and I have done it wrong plenty of times before. So we've just been skating along together for 20-plus years. We met right after his son died, when Houndy was in such a bad way, in such grief, he couldn't even catch himself any lobsters anymore. Lobsters just walked on by his traps and got in other people's traps, and Houndy was so battered by life he didn't even care all that much, except he was going to starve to death. So somebody told him to come see me, and I chanted some words of power summoning the forces of plenty, and put my hands on his heart. And after that, lobsters started standing in line to get in his traps. He brought me some one night to show me my spell had worked, and we stayed up late and ate lobsters and drank some homemade wine I had, and then, I don't know how it got started, we found ourselves dancing. And of course, dancing is the gateway drug to kissing, and somehow that night Houndy brought the laughter back into my eyes. And maybe I did us a little love spell that has always stood me in good stead when I've needed it. So here we are, 2 decades later. Me doing my words of power and finding love for people when I can, and him bringing me his old craggy Brooklyn self and his scratchy chin and his happy snoring. And lobsters. And in the mornings, I fix him poached eggs and salmon, and make him smoothies that have plenty of antioxidants, and bread that I've baked, filled with seeds and sprouts. And then we sit outside in the sun on the roof, and listen to the city moving beneath us and feel the energy of life. Well, I do. Houndy sits next to me and smiles like he's the Buddha or something, even though I don't think he has a spiritual cell in his body. Maybe that's why the universe sent him to me. We're counterbalanced. The universe always likes things to have a balance to them. A door slams upstairs and the building's day begins. Voices on the stairs. Did you get your lunch from the countertop? And did you get a pencil? And since it's the last day of school, you won't have aftercare, so you'll come home on the bus and then, well, you and I will call each other, right? I'll call you every week. No, every day, Sammy. Promise me, every day. And then there are 2 sets of footsteps clumping downstairs. Jessica's sandals carefully slapping on the wood, and Sammy's exuberant sneakers. And Sammy knocks his scooter against my door as he passes, just like he always does. It's supposedly an accident, and Jessica says she tries to get him not to do it, but I always tell her I don't mind. It's our ritual. Sammy is leaving for the day, and he wants me to see him out. I jump up and go to the back door and throw it open, and there he is in the hall, the sweetest boy, 10 years old, with his yellow hair sticking up and his pale, fair skin practically see-through in the light from my kitchen windows, peering at the world through those adorable, giant, round glasses he loves. And he's grinning at me. Sammy, I say, and we do a fist bump, which is hard because of the scooter he's carrying and the outsized New York Mets backpack he's wearing. Jessica's next to him with her harried morning face, and as usual, she's juggling her cup of coffee, her bag, the car keys, and her 1,000 worries, and at any moment she could drop any of it except the worries. But today she also looks like she's about to burst into tears. Not only is it Sammy's last day of school, but for the very first time his dad, whom Jessica hates in the way you can only hate somebody you once loved beyond reason, is going to take Sammy upstate to stay with him and his mysterious new girlfriend, whom Jessica had never even seen, for a whole month. The court said this had to happen, and Jessica fought it for as long as humanly possible, but now today is the day. When she got the news, she asked me if there was any way Houndy and I could hand Sammy over to the ex, since she didn't think she could do it without falling apart. So we're going to. Sammy says,
Blix, Blix, guess what? Did you know that when I come back from my dad's, I'm gonna know how to play the drums?
What? You're going to be even more amazing than you already are? I say, high-fiving him three more times. You're going to play the drums? He rocks back on his heels and grins at me and nods.
I'm going to drummer camp.
Jessica rolls her eyes.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Andrew makes a lot of promises he can't keep.
Mom, says Sammy, he's gonna do it.
Let's hope so, says Jessica grimly.
Poor thing. She is a woman who has been given more than she thought she could handle, including a cheating husband and a boy who is sort of quirky. She's always twisting her rings around and around on her hands and looking worried. I'm always beaming love toward her and watching as she gets bombarded with all the little love particles, but so far none of them seem to have landed in a permanent way. I think she's kind of enjoying being furious with her ex for now, if you want to know the truth. It's hard to make room for love when anger still feels so good.
So, Sammy, my boy, I say, Houndy and I will meet you at the bus stop outside, and then we'll hang out here to wait for your dad.
Wait, Mama's not gonna stay with me?
No, baby cakes. Today you get me and Houndy and some chocolate chip cookies.
He turns to Jessica with his tiny serious eyes.
Is it because you're too sad to say goodbye to me?
She has one of those faces that shows every single one of her thoughts marching across, and now she has about 57 thoughts at once, most of them tragic.
I have to work late today, so I thought Blix could meet up with your daddy instead.
She fiddles with her keys, wipes at her eyes, gets busy shuffling her bag over to her other shoulder.
It's okay, says Sammy.
He tucks his hand into hers.
I know. You're too sad to see my daddy take me. But it's going to be okay, Mama.
You see, this is when I want to rush in, slather them with love.
I want you to go off and be happy, she says. But
no, I think. I send her a stop message. Don't say the next part, that you don't want him to love his daddy and the new girlfriend more than he loves you. She clears her throat, and our eyes meet. She's about to cry. So I go over and hug her and him both, mostly so I can block her from saying that she's terrified that Sammy's not going to want to come back to her, that the drum lessons and the novelty of attention from his father and his dad's girlfriend are going to make him want to stay away forever, that she's afraid her world with him, the world of homework and sadness and the grind of school, can never measure up to a month in the Berkshires, with a lake and a drum camp. Ah, love, why does it have to get all convoluted? I've been 85 years on this planet, and I still think the universe could have worked out a better system than this stumbling mess we find ourselves in. I kiss Sammy on the top of his delicious little head and tell him I'll see him later. I squeeze Jessica's arm, and then they're off. But first she turns and gives me a look, a tearful look that says all is lost. All is not lost, I beam to her. I'm always beaming love messages and light over to Jessica, but Lola next door, who is keeping score, says that Jessica's negative vibes are so far winning against my efforts. Lola jokingly claims to have an Excel spreadsheet on what she calls my human being projects, and that she can tell me just how all of them are going on any given date, The numbers would show, she says, that my Jessica project might be a little bit lacking in success. Which doesn't mean a thing, of course, because, as I've explained to Lola, everything can reverse in an instant when the vibes change. And if you want to know the truth, my Lola project might need some tending, too. She's been a widow forever, which she claims is fine. But I happen to know that, with just a tiny bit of courage, she could be having the time of her life and could love again. I keep calling for the universe to send her love, doing little love spells here and there when I think of them. But Lola, she can't see it. So I have Jessica and Lola, and now I also have Marnie. And oh yes, then there's Patrick. Houndy comes into the kitchen, scratching his huge round belly and smiling. Is that our boy off to school already? Yep. And today's the day he's going away for a month to see his dad. Oh, no. I've got to tell him goodbye. You'll see him later. But Houndy's already bounding off, going out the back door and down the stairs, and I hear him reach Sammy and Jessica and hear them all talking at once. And then, after a bit, he comes clomping back up the stairs, winded as hell, with Lola following him, wearing her lavender house dress and carrying a cardboard tray of cups filled with iced coffee that she goes and buys every morning, even though it makes no sense at all. We can make our own coffee. But that's Lola. She's been my best friend forever, in this life and probably about 5 lives before this one, if you believe in that sort of thing, and I do, so I don't question her. I start throwing fruit into the blender to make us our daily kale strawberry smoothies, and Lola gets out the frying pan to fix the eggs for the mushroom omelet that we'll take up onto the roof. We all have our jobs to do to get breakfast going. By the way, says Houndy, while he's collecting the plates and silverware, I told Jessica she might as well come up after work, have a glass of wine so she doesn't go home and cry herself to sleep. That girl, she always looks like she's going to fall apart. The phone rings just then, and it's Patrick. The phone seems to ring in an altogether different tone when it's him. He lives in the basement apartment, the one that's almost completely underground, which he claims suits him perfectly. And he's calling to find out if a package was delivered for him yesterday. I tell him no, but invite him up for eggs and mushrooms anyway. He's an introvert of the highest order, and so he hesitates and says he might come. Only first he's got to write all the symptoms of all the diseases that have ever been recorded and invent a computer program that will cure Alzheimer's, so he'll probably be busy for a while getting that done. I laugh. Get on up here, you big galoot. You can save the world from illness after breakfast, I tell him, and he sighs, which means he's not coming. Come on, I say. We'll sit up on the roof, just the 4 of us. I'd have to take a shower first. No, you don't. We'll be on the roof. The fresh air will blow the stink off you. My hair isn't good. I should at least wash that. Put on your hat. You're always wearing a hat. I get out the cloth napkins and put them on the tray. I'm distracted suddenly by a dust mote that seems lit up in a sunbeam. My hairline is tingling just a little. And I should cut my toenails, maybe. Now you're just toying with me. Get up here, yells Houndy from across the room. We need more representation by testosterone. Don't make me cope with these women by myself. Patrick says something about how he's already eaten breakfast, and he really does have a lot of work to do. And also, he's waiting on a package. He's lobbing excuses like they're pebbles, and he's laughing while he does it, knowing that I understand that he can't come. It's not one of the days when Patrick can do stuff. If I squint, I suddenly see little points of light everywhere. My head feels funny, like something is trying to signal me. I have to sit down, I whisper to Lola, and she gives me an odd look. Houndy has taken the tray and gone on upstairs to the roof, and I hear the door slam behind him. Feel how the whole building shakes, like it's answering him.
Are you dizzy? She says.
No.
Maybe you need some water instead of coffee. Here.
She turns to the sink and runs the tap. That's not... And then I know what it is. Marnie. Patrick needs Marnie. They are a match. So much clicks into place. Why, it was essential for me to go to my niece's Christmas party in Virginia, even though my family drives me nuts. Why I needed to meet Marnie, and why Noah hooked up with a woman that he isn't going to keep loving. Oh, my God. As though we've all come together in some kind of elaborate dance for Patrick and Marnie. Patrick and Marnie. Old souls who need to find each other. I love when it happens this way. Even now I feel my body, tired and creaky as it is, running with energy. Lola is looking at me closely. Oh boy, she says. I know what it means when you look like this. Something is happening. Later I'll tell you, I say. Right now I need to think. And she and I go up to the roof, and we look out over the city and soak up the early summer morning light while we eat. It is so beautiful here, and life is so full of possibilities, even though I'm not going to be here for much longer. How can I bear to leave, knowing there is so much undone? I have to trust the universe to make it all work out for them. I watch the doorway, but Patrick does not come upstairs to the rooftop. He's downstairs pounding away on his computer keyboard, trapped by his own demons. And Marnie? Marnie's heart is being broken somewhere far away. I can feel it. You are going to be okay, I beam to her. And then, to them both, be brave. Be brave. There is so much fear to wade through before you get to love.
6. Marnie. Natalie texts me 2 days into my honeymoon. Is honeymoon Noah behaving better than wedding Noah? Much better, I write back. Hashtag all good. Whew, thank goodness. And then I look across the table at my handsome, tousled husband, who is sipping his Bloody Mary and gazing out through his Ray-Ban sunglasses at the turquoise sea just beyond the jungle. He looks like an ad for the tropics. We are having a perfectly normal late breakfast on the hotel restaurant's deck after having perfectly normal honeymoon sex last night, and I'm glad to report that Noah looks tanned and well-rested and not anxious at all. There is just one tiny little thing. Underneath the table, his knee is bouncing up and down like it's connected to an unseen metronome. He feels me concentrating on him and looks at me. We both smile, and I turn back to my eggs quickly before I have to see his smile fading. Jesus. He's going to break up with me. He's just waiting for the right moment. Which is probably why I've had a headache practically the entire time we've been here. I feel that my smile must look like a rictus grin, something you'd see on a skeleton. No wonder the waiter put our food on the table and backed away fast. Noah, I say, and then can't quite recall what I meant to say after that. What? He says. Do you love me? And do you remember when you first started spending the night at my apartment, how sometimes my old bed frame would crash onto the floor when we made love? We started having to drag the mattress to the living room before sex. You joked that moving the mattress was the most exciting foreplay you'd ever had, and I knew I wanted to keep you forever. Nothing. Never mind.
Do you want to go on a hike this afternoon?
He says grimly. So we do. We walk through the little town and out into the jungle. He walks along quietly, like a man walking to his doom, stopping every once in a while to look at birds through his pair of binoculars, or to solemnly hand me the bottled water he put in the backpack. When his long, lovely fingers brush mine, I have to squeeze my eyes tight so that I don't cry. I am stumbling along the path behind him, tears blinding me, when I hear a voice in my head saying, "You're going to be okay. Be brave." That's when I take a deep breath, and I say to his back, "Noah, tell me what's the matter." And he turns and looks at me, and I see that my weak old marriage is about to die right there on a path in the Costa Rican jungle. It isn't that he's gone crazy or is suffering from anxiety or any of the things I have tried to tell myself. It's worse than that. It really does turn out to be lawnmowers. "Lawnmowers," I say blankly. Ahead of us on the path is a middle-aged couple in matching Bermuda shorts and powder blue t-shirts. When she passed us, the woman told me that if you wear light blue, butterflies might land on you. She said this giggling, and the man had laughed, too, and then they'd set out on the path, arm in arm. I watch their retreating backs. She is oblivious to the fact that there is a butterfly riding on her back. "Excuse me, sir," I say in a low voice, only for Noah's benefit, once they are out of earshot. "Sir, I know this may sound strange, but could I ask you your deepest feelings about the lawnmower in your garage? Are you in any way afraid of it, sir?"
"Shut up, Marnie," Noah says.
"No, please, Noah. Tell me these fears you have, the ones you've just discovered in yourself on the day you got married to me." He scowls.
"It's the tyranny of lawnmowers, not the things themselves," he says. "And it's not just the lawnmowers. I don't want any of it. The lawn, the household budgets, the electric bill, the daily conversation that goes, 'How was your day?' No, how was your day? Did you have a good day? I can't do it."
The tyranny of lawnmowers and being asked, "How was your day?" I say slowly. "You can't do 'How was your day?'" The sky is full of birds. Parrots are screaming around us.
"You are going to be okay, Marnie."
He shrugs and looks off into the distance, ruggedly handsome and bored with me. A memory swims up in my head of the time last year when he went with me to Florida to meet my parents. My mother, a firm believer in the getting to a man's heart through his stomach theory of romance, insisted on cooking us dinner. We all sat there in my mom's little suburban kitchen with the rooster wallpaper and the rooster salt and pepper shakers, and she made us her signature dish, which my father nicknamed Millie's Magnificent Masterpiece Meatloaf, so named because she melts whole chunks of two different kinds of cheese into the meat, and then she serves it, glistening with ketchup poured over the top. Ketchup! Only the finest for the McGraws. For as long as I can remember, Thursday has always been meatloaf night, and every single week my father would rub his hands together in great anticipation and exclaim as though it were Thanksgiving and Christmas and the 4th of July all at once. And here they were, sharing this with my new boyfriend, and they were so happy about it. It broke my heart, all this optimism they had for us, when I could see, with paralyzing shame, that this handsome, bright-eyed boyfriend of mine, sitting there in their modest little three-bedroom ranch, was watching them with a dazed half-smile on his face. I knew that look. He was fashioning this whole incident into a comedy routine he'd entertain people with later. Like, "Really, dude, ketchup on the top," he'd say. "Please tell me you're not really going to use two kinds of cheese inside. It's too extravagant for words." He doesn't get domestic life. The way you can be glad for such stupid, simple things. That you can bicker and fight your way through marriage, and then Thursday night Meatloaf comes to save you. I should have known.